Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Markowitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report. Please everyone, be sure to go back through the week as boy oh boy, it was a busy one with a lot of company updates again, both production and exploration companies, as well as a lot of market commentary as we continue to see volatility really across the board. We are kicking off the show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, you focus on a wide range of sectors, and that's why we love having you on, because you really have a balanced approach when looking at different markets and balancing out the economic data. I want to start with U.S. equity markets because they've been more volatile this year. And right now, as we're recording this, which is later in the day on Wednesday, the S&P is little over 5% off of its recent highs, and those recent highs came earlier this year. We have seen a bit larger down days when it comes to volume and even the moves down. And I think the more interesting thing is after the most recent little pullback over the last week and a half, we haven't seen the markets just push back to all-time highs. It's been much more of a choppy motion, and a lot of it does deal with this rotation out of tech or out of, let's say, growth into value. Jesse, take us through your outlook of the general health of these U.S. markets, please.
Well, I think the key thing to understand here is that the Fed, through, you know, printing $5 trillion over the last 22 months, really stoked animal spirits in a way that we haven't seen in at least 20 years since, you know, the late 90s dot-com mania. But even I think that this bubble in stock prices is bigger than what we saw back then. At least the speculative fervor today is more extreme, more dramatic than what we saw back then. That's not just my opinion. Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner, came out and said as much recently. But I think if you lived through that period of the dot-com mania and witnessed some of the extreme moves we saw in a handful of stocks back then, and you lived through this recent episode as well, it's pretty obvious that what we've seen recently, it was much more extreme in terms of the amount of leverage used, right? Investors using call options and margin debt and things, leveraged ETFs in a way that they weren't able to use back then. And then the breadth of the speculation, it's just gone into a number of different asset classes and things. You know, I think a friend of mine suggested that the Fed did so much to stoke animal spirits that animal spirits got rabies. And I thought that was just the perfect way to put it, that literally investors went crazy during this cycle. And so with the hint of even reduction of all this stimulus, you start to see these animal spirits begin to wane. And this is a concept, this animal spirits concept, that's been around really since the invention of central banking, and central bankers understand their ability to stoke investor risk appetite or to diminish it through what, you know, through money printing. And so I think that, you know, that's the big thing that people really need to pay attention to is the Fed has only just begun to reduce the amount of stimulus. It's still printing money every single month, $60 billion this month, $30 billion next month. And hopefully, you know, they say they're going to get to zero in March, but they're still printing a ton of money. And already we're seeing things like the ARK Innovation ETF down 50%. And a lot of these, you know, stocks, popular stocks, meme stocks and things, down, you know, 70-80%. And that's, to me, just a representation of this reversal in animal spirits.
Yeah, Jesse, that's absolutely what we're seeing. It's almost like end of cycle kind of data that's coming out. One of the tweets you had sent out a week or two back talked about the largest five companies in the U.S. trade for 46 times free cash flow, or 57 times if you remove the cash flow. So that's very frothy levels. But you had another tweet right after that talking about NFTs, the cryptos, the meme stocks, and rarely has money felt more fake. That was an article that was on Vox. And it just seems like these are end of cycle kind of things that happen because of the Fed juicing the market so much. Do you think that we're going to see the tree get shaken here and some of these traders that have come in since the pandemic started, and maybe it's the first time being in the markets, maybe they get a little reality check here on where some of these valuations have been?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you think about where do these animal spirits come from, right? It's the Fed buys up $5 trillion worth of risk-free assets, reducing their supply. So investors who are holding those are left with cash. They're forced to go into something out on the risk curve. And the Fed has said explicitly, this is the point of quantitative easing, is to push people out the risk curve, force them to buy riskier and riskier securities. And so you see that happening. But as you mentioned, we see it in cryptocurrencies, you see it in call options. One of the statistics that just blows my mind is I think there was over $800 billion spent last year just in Tesla call option premiums. That's mind-boggling, right? I mean, almost $1 trillion just in Tesla call option premiums. So the Fed was extremely successful in pushing people out the risk curve. To come back to the psychology, you think of, you know, these acronyms, and, you know, TINA is maybe the most popular. There is no alternative to owning stocks. And that's what the Fed does. When they buy up risk-free assets, push interest rates to zero, they force you into risk assets. There is no alternative to owning risk assets. But now that inflation is here, the Fed is forced to deal with it. Interest rates are going up across the curve. We're seeing this from the short end to the long end. Interest rates going up. Well, now there is all of a sudden an alternative to owning stocks. And that alternative is getting more attractive by the day. And so what does that mean? That means to me that valuations have to come down in a meaningful way. And you pointed out the extreme valuations in the biggest stocks in the market. You know, it was a report from my friend Eric Cinnamond, who does some fantastic fundamental research on markets and especially small cap securities. But if you just look at the five biggest stocks in the market, the way I calculate it, and I use aggregate price to free cash flow. So you take the total market cap of all five of these companies, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Tesla, Google. Put that all together, you get whatever it is. It's probably $7-8 trillion, something like that. And then you take their total free cash flow, put all their free cash flow together. Back in 2012, 13, 14, these stocks traded at 10 times free cash flow on an aggregate basis. Today, they trade almost 40 times free cash flow. So that is that animal spirits TINA effect. We've seen valuations quadruple. So how much do valuations have to come back to reflect now that there is an alternative to owning stocks? And I don't know the answer to that, but I know that these stocks shouldn't trade 40 times. Maybe it's 25 times. But even if they were to drop that much, I mean, that's a 30-40% decline in the stock prices. So that's potentially, the risk that lies ahead so long as rates keep going up.
So Jesse, in all fairness, we have seen some stocks just get crushed. Actually, more than 50% of the stocks, at least let's say in the NASDAQ or other of the major markets, have gotten hit quite hard, but it's been that concentration of money into a select few stocks that really has kept the general equity or the broad markets, the broad averages, looking more attractive than what the underlying stocks are actually doing. And I understand the argument that as rates go up, it does get more attractive for some investors to get into, but rates are still very low. So do you think that, again, instead of completely exiting the market, we will just continue to see this concentration of cash in select stocks?
Well, to me, it comes back to margins, right? I mean, inflation has historically been bad for financial assets. It's been bad for stocks, stock prices. Why is that? Well, it's because inflation pressures profit margins. Today, we have the highest corporate profit margins in history. Corporations earn more, the every dollar that they make in revenue flows to the bottom line in terms of profits than we've ever seen before. To me, that's a function of, a number of dynamics. But one of those is just labor shares, that companies have been able to pay employees less because the supply of labor was so great, but also because they could offshore production to places that had much cheaper labor. Now, what we're seeing today, and this is showing up in bank earnings over the last week or so, Goldman Sachs this week came out with salaries, I think, at Goldman were up 33% last year from the year before, set the cost of salaries and compensation. And banks are early in the earnings cycle, but if this turns into a trend, that, and it looks like it, I mean, you look at like wages, wage growth and these kinds of things, that it's basically very supportive of the idea that profit margins are going to fall. Another indicator that I like to look at, and is very actually predictive of S&P 500 profit margins, is small business surveys from the NFIB. And they show that when compensation plans are really rising rapidly among small businesses, that leads a decline in profit margins by about, I think it's 6 to 9 months or something like that. So this is why, optimism with small businesses and stuff is declining pretty significantly, not because they're worried about the top line probably, but because they're worried about the bottom line, that they can't hire enough people to meet demand. And the people they do hire, in order to keep them working, they're having to raise wages dramatically. So if we see this, this wage pressure that we've seen at the banks and in small business surveys and things, if this materializes into S&P 500 earnings over the next couple of quarters, you're going to see a pretty significant earnings decline this year. And if so, that is going to put even greater pressure on stock prices, which, if you believe, they have to reflect a lower multiple on those earnings, which if those earnings are declined, that makes for an even larger decline in price to make up that difference. So there's a lot of kind of bearish headwinds for the stock market at present. I think margins is one we got to pay very close attention to.
Well, Jesse, when we just zoom back and look at the larger macro picture here, where the Fed, as you mentioned, is continuing to taper, meaning they're still spending, but they're spending less and they want to get it down to zero. They're going to be hiking rates, many people believe, 3 to 4 times throughout the year. But there's also this backdrop of persistent inflation, which is why they want to start hiking it. But also the same period of time, high energy prices, wages going up, as you just outlined. And then all of these GDP growth forecasts are starting to look a little bit more bearish as we look forward. Is it possible the Fed is getting ready to create a policy error by deciding to do this rate hiking cycle in an almost stagflationary backdrop right as the economy is starting to slow down?
Well, it's a great question. I think that in order to rein in inflation, the Fed will be forced to create a recession. Now, I don't know if they're willing to do that or not. I personally don't think they are willing to do that. They've shown us very clearly that the full employment side of the dual mandate is far more important to them than the stable prices side of the dual mandate. And so, but I do think the only way the Fed is going to rein in inflation at this point is by creating a recession, by letting rates, raising rates to a degree that reduces demand enough to cause recessions. But I don't think, like I said, I don't think they're willing to do that. That's potentially what the markets are starting to sniff out here, is that the Fed, is not able to do enough to rein in inflation. And if so, then, what we're seeing in, the dollar and in gold and in things are the beginning of very important trends for those assets.
So Jesse, when we take a big picture look at the Fed and their impact on the markets, a wide range of markets, I don't want to sound too simplistic, but doesn't it make sense that if the Fed is starting to taper and might even be raising rates, that the bond market should actually pull back because the Fed is such a large buyer of bonds? That could also make people look a little bit more favorably towards the US dollar. And quite frankly, if you are injecting less liquidity into the markets and eventually even stopping that liquidity, then markets should generally correct. But that all depends on how slow the Fed goes so that there isn't a shock to the system. Isn't that what the Fed is trying to balance?
Well, I think that, the Fed is trying to balance a variety of things. They want to try and rein in inflation, but they don't want to crash the asset markets or the economy and at the same time. And that is a balancing act that we're going to witness play out this year. But I think the most important thing to pay attention to right now? Is that from 2009 or 2008-09 when the Fed really started QE till 2019, just before the repo fiasco, that there was a very clear pattern where when the Fed initiated QE, interest rates went up. And when they began to taper QE or QE came to an end, interest rates went down. And to me, that was a very clear sign that the markets were saying, okay, when the Fed initiates support through QE, that's good for the economy, so interest rates should go up. When the Fed ends QE, that's ends that, you know, monetary support for the economy, that's bearish for the economy, so interest rates should come down. In 2019, we saw something different happen where the Fed was reducing the size of the balance sheet, and all of a sudden we had the repo fiasco where the Fed had to come back into the markets, into the Treasury markets, and reinitiate QE. This is before the pandemic hit. I'm talking about the fall of 2019. And to me, that was a sign that the Treasury market, the federal debt levels, were getting to a point where they couldn't function effectively without the Fed's intervention involvement. Now, the total debt of the federal government has grown dramatically since then, in the 2+ years since that time. And what we're seeing today is, an affirmation of that view, which is the Fed has just started to taper and interest rates are starting to take off across the curve. To me, that is a sign that, you know, what you would expect is what we saw from 2009 to 2019, I think, is that the Fed is reducing monetary stimulus for the economy. That should be bearish for the economy. And as such, the market, the bond market, should rally, interest rates come down as a sign of a potentially slowing economy. But we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing the Fed just start to taper asset purchases and interest rates are going up. And that's, to me, a sign that this Treasury market, there is not enough natural demand for Treasuries that the Fed can step away and allow the market to just function, you know, be left to its own devices. And this, to me, is a very significant thing to pay attention to, because if the Fed continues to taper over the next couple of months and interest rates continue to go up, they could, you know, create this very quickly, this type of a recessionary reaction in the economy and the markets. I mean, imagine if the 10-year, you know, were to go to 3%, which is not, you know, unreasonable in light of a 7% CPI print. If the 10-year goes to 3, the housing market is in trouble. And so I really don't think the Fed can afford to allow, can afford to leave the market to its own devices if interest rates are going to just continue to power higher without their significant involvement.
Yeah, Jesse, you make a great point there. And it's also interesting that the rates are going up when the Fed is pulling back their buying. So as you mentioned, there doesn't seem to be enough buyers of bonds, hence the rates are going higher. And there could be a rotation out of bonds, because even if you were in a 10-year for 1.8%, or even if you were making 3%, as you outlined, the CPI reading, the headline number is 7%. So you're still getting eroded by 4% with a negative real rate to even do that trade. So could there be a rotation out of bonds and into other asset classes? And could some of that money make its way into the safe havens of maybe the dollar or gold or both at the same time?
We have another situation here where things are going on and it's contrary to what you would expect. We're seeing interest rates go up, and at the same time, we're seeing silver and gold prices go up strongly as well. And that is counterintuitive. I think that's one of the things that's held buyers back, just retail buyers of precious metals, is to say, look, you can't buy these things when the Fed is tightening policy and when interest rates are going to go up. But what we're seeing is long rates go up and precious metals, you know, to me, the gold price is breaking out. It's broken that downtrend. Did at the very end of last year, broken that downtrend line, and now we're breaking above horizontal support at around 1832 is kind of where I see it. And at the same time, interest rates are going up. And so to me, that is a sign that precious metals investors are waking up to the fact that the Fed will not be able to taper all the way to zero. They'll certainly not be able to reduce the balance sheet, because they can't afford to let 10-year, 30-year rates, 5-year rates, go up to, 3, 4, 5%. And that is what potentially could happen if they follow through on this hawkish tapering talk. And so I think the markets are starting to realize the Fed is trapped. The Fed can't follow through. And the Fed is really hoping, you know, really what they were hoping for, I think, is that they'll be able to use forward guidance, all this hawkish talk, to do their work for them, that markets will price in, you know, tapering, tightening without them having to actually do it, because there is really no way they can follow through. So to the extent that we're going to see the Fed back off of these the hawkish talk and be able to not follow through on it is extremely bullish for gold prices. You know, I think as we talked last time, we spoke about a month ago, I was saying the dollar has now priced in 4 rate hikes and a complete tapering and potentially a reduction, you know, of the balance sheet. So to any extent that the Fed is unable to follow through on that, the markets have to reprice. And I think that's what we were seeing with the dollar, you know, decline last week significantly in the wake of the CPI report. And I think it's what we're seeing with gold today is that, you know, maybe the markets went too far in pricing in a hawkish shift in monetary policy.
Yeah, well, it's all about time frame, right, Jesse? Because we don't know how far the Fed is going to get with their rate hikes. They don't even know how far they're going to get or even fully through the taper, but they are going to continue to talk the markets in that direction, and we'll see where that leaves the markets and just when the markets make them pivot. But more specifically on to gold, I know that as we're recording this on Wednesday, very encouraging day for the gold and gold stocks. However, it depends what time frame you're looking at a chart, because you go back to mid-2020, the peak in gold. It's been a pretty devastating, although not huge percentage-wise, but grinding downtrend, lower highs and mixed lows in all fairness. Recently, we've had some higher lows, but we went almost a year there with lower lows being had. What are the key levels that you're looking for in the gold price that would give, I guess, the generalist investor a little bit more confidence saying that, look, gold finally is breaking out. It's not going to be another head fake.
Well, I mean, to me, I'm already, so I like to look at a variety of things to analyze any market, primarily fundamentals, sentiment, and technicals. So fundamentals for me, for the gold price, are real rates are still deeply negative. That suggests to me that there is a very strong underpinning for gold prices today. It's why we, like you said, it's been actually a very shallow correction. We've seen, what is it, 15% or something like that in gold price. It's been longer than a lot of people had probably hoped, but it's been pretty shallow. And I think that's because of this strong fundamental underpinning. If gold prices were to follow this relationship with real rates, gold price should be way over 2,000 an ounce today. So to me, I see a margin of safety fundamentally in the gold price that makes me very comfortable buying significant position. And you know, I have been doing like we've been talking about over the last few months. But from a sentiment standpoint too, that it gives me a great deal of confidence when you look at. My friend Tom McClellan makes a great point. When you look at the gold price and ETF flows, it can be a great contrarian signal. When you saw the gold price peak in August of 2020, ETF flows continued positively even after gold prices rolled over and fell a couple hundred bucks. We saw flows continue to go into gold ETFs, which was a contrarian bearish signal that investors shouldn't have been buying as prices were going down. But we're seeing the opposite over the last, you know, 2-3 months, whereas prices have actually been moving higher really since those August through October lows. And money continues to flow out of ETFs. That makes me very, very happy. It makes me feel very comfortable that investors are really still shunning the precious metals. And that's a very contrarian bullish sign for me. And then technically, we talked about some levels. To me, I see this as a bullish, symmetrical triangle, essentially kind of like a pennant pattern. Typically, it's just signals a corrective phase in an ongoing bull market. That's exactly what I see from, you know, August of 2020 till now is just a corrective pattern in an ongoing bull market. And we're seeing a breakout above this 1830-ish level, 32. If we see a breakout above that November high, You know, people are not going to stay bearish for very long. We're going to see ETF flows pick up again, and it's going to be that retail investor getting excited in gold again that's really going to see this next leg, you know, higher in gold prices. And it could be an explosive one. Like I said, gold price should be way over 2,000 an ounce today already based on fundamentals. And all it needs is, you know, basically that catalyst, that Fed catalyst, paired with retail investors moving back to gold. And I think they're going to do that as the technicals continue to improve.
Well, Jesse, just before we wrap up, you had mentioned off mic before we started recording that you were starting to dabble in some of the larger producers, in particular Agnico Eagle, and you made some observations about, you know, the forward guidance on their earnings and where they're valued to historical levels. I'd love you to unpack that real quick and just what you're seeing as an analog to the gold mining sector.
Well, this is going to maybe date me a little bit, but one of the things that I've done since the very beginning of my career is I love to look through Value Line Investment Survey. Every time it comes out every week, I look through all whatever it is, 100 stocks that they send. And it's just a great way to, I mean, it's kind of like a visual scan for me. I just look for stocks that are trading significantly below their quote unquote value line. And you know, that's where the name comes from, is they basically publish the stock. They show you a long-term chart of the stock and a line, essentially that's the fair value. It's like the historical valuation range for the company. And when you look at that for Agnico, this is really kind of what drew my attention to it. And it's something that a stock I've been buying for a couple of months now, pretty heavily. But when you look at it relative to that fair value, and I think Value Line puts a 20 times cash flow fair value on it, it's never been as cheap today at any time in the past 15 or 20 years. The only time it came close was in 2015 when the stock traded at about a 60 to 70% discount to fair value, its Value Line version of the fair value. And I think that's roughly where it is today, 60, 70%. I mean, the stock's going to do $6-$7 in cash flow this year. You know, put a 20 multiple on that, and the stock price is 50 today. So, you know, it's at least 50% undervalued by a lot of measures. And I think that's just investors betting on a cyclical peak in gold prices. Now, if it turns out this is not a cyclical peak in gold prices and that this is just a corrective phase in an ongoing bull market, as I mentioned, then they're going to have to re-rate all of these gold mining stocks much higher. They shouldn't be trading at, you know, Agnico trades at 5 times enterprise value to EBITDA. Over the last 10 years, it's traded 10 to 15 times. So, it's worth at least 10 times EBITDA today. The stock price needs to double to get there and could easily trade, you know, 15 times. So it's just amazing to me to see inflation arise the way that it has, and the best inflation protection in the stock market on sale like this. It's mind boggling.
We're going to leave it there. But Jesse, you're not alone in wondering why gold and the gold miners especially haven't moved with negative real rates, higher inflation, this environment that everyone was told was perfect for gold and the gold stocks. Well, unfortunately, been in fairly lengthy correction right now. But again, gold really hasn't dropped that much from its highs, but it feels more painful than the actual percentage decline. Either way, hey, you're setting up a very rosy picture for precious metals in the near term and the long term, so we'll see how that all plays out. Jesse, great chatting with you as always, buddy. I love reading over your stuff over at the Felder Report, and we really appreciate you taking time on our show. So thanks for your time this weekend, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, Corey. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. We are, again, talking broad markets, but also going to get into the precious metals as we are chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. Also writes the Lion Share website, which I will include a link to within the weekend show posting. Dana, starting off with the U.S. equity markets. We were talking a lot tail end of last year about how weak breadth was and the little bit of choppiness that we saw at the tail end of the year, as well as that rotation more into value out of growth. If we look at the S&P so far this month, it's down 5%. The NASDAQ is down almost 8% this month and down 3% this week as we are recording later in the day on Thursday. What's your thoughts on these U.S. markets? Is this a dip to be bought right now?
Maybe for a trade, like we spoke about before I came on. The breadth deterioration, you know, since November is serious enough to suggest more of the, on the lines of an intermediate term correction. So probably on the order of a couple more months, even. Depends how fast we get to conditions that are that have sufficiently corrected that divergence and corrected the investment, the investor bullishness and the extremes there in sentiment. So, what we saw obviously was, the broad market and the smaller caps break down or at least top out in back in, November, and now are breaking down some below some key technical levels. At the same time, the large caps and the large cap averages hold up much better, obviously, into the beginning of this year. But invariably, when you look at the types of divergences we saw with breadth, with the number of stocks hitting new lows, even as the indices were hitting new highs towards the end of the year, those types of divergences almost always turn into something more serious on the downside. So what we've seen over the last 2 weeks is basically the large caps and some of the other sectors that had held up kind of catching down to the broader market. If that's the case, if they're going to follow the broader market lower, they've got still got quite a bit of catching up to do on the downside. So this could get a little bit more serious and take a little bit more time to run its course before, a more sustainable dip is to be bought.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems almost like passive investors that just bought the indexes did a lot better last year and even heading into this year than investors that may have diversified into multiple stocks, because many of those stocks in those sectors, whether it's the S&P or the NASDAQ or the Russell 2000, got hammered. They're down 30, 40, 50%, where when you look at the indexes, it gives you a lot better feeling that, hey, things have been pretty good for the last year. Are there any sectors or individual companies that you're shorting right now? Because I know you play both sides of the market, Dana. Are there sectors that you feel are still going to stay under pressure for a while?
I mean, the growth areas are obviously your relative laggards right now. And we always want to be buying relative strength into dips and shorting or selling relative laggards into bounces. So anything growth related, we want to be selling or shorting on the bounces. Again, nothing's going to be straight down, so you want to pick your spots with that. But anything that's broken some key technical levels, you look at technology or consumer discretionary, obviously the small caps, anything growth that we've talked about, those types of areas, I would not hesitate to be shorting, again, at the right levels. Some areas, some international areas as well, look like they are pretty vulnerable right now. And again, if the sectors and all of the cap weighted areas are to catch up to the downside to match what, the broader market and the smaller caps have done on the downside, then there'll probably be nowhere to hide once this thing is has run its course. But obviously you want to continue to ride the trend. So that means you're shorting those areas in growth that have broken some key technical levels that are more vulnerable to further downside.
So Dana, let's switch focus here and talk about precious metals, because that was a topic that we covered a lot this week because of the moves that we saw on Wednesday, specifically in gold and the gold stocks that both moved higher. GDX was up something like 7% on Wednesday. Silver started moving on Tuesday, and Wednesday also got a buy as well as the stocks. And commodities broadly have done well this week. take into consideration the GDX just this month is still only up 2%, but this is a much better week. What's your take on that bounce we saw on Wednesday? Is it the start of another uptrend in your eyes?
Well, it could be. I think it was a key day. I don't say that too often either. From a longer term perspective, we do think there's another up leg of the precious metals bull market. We saw that big rally that ran up into the former highs that ended in the mid, say, summer of 2020 in gold. And then around that key Fibonacci retracement and a lot of the gold miners and gold miner funds. So we think this is, since 2020, this is more or less of a consolidation of that rally and gearing up for another big up move. The question is always from what level and when does that begin? So we did. We were actually had a short position on the gold miners over the last several weeks. It looked like to us that it might be setting up for one more move lower after testing the same levels, the same support levels multiple times. That didn't happen as of yesterday. We saw a nice breakout above some key levels. Got it. Most of these miners, ETFs, as well as the metals, we got it out of harm's way. Considering the consolidation has been, it's still got plenty of resistance. And when I say it, I'm talking about the precious metals complex in general. It's got plenty of resistance to get through still. So again, that's not going to be a straight shot up. But it did recover some key technical levels, started making at least a near-term higher high, which is important, got it out of harm's way, like I said, and might be the start of, you know, at least starting to make its way back up higher. So we are out of our shorts, flip long again. Gold and silver, we have maintained a small long position. As we improve that, the technical position in those areas will continue to accumulate positions there. But as of yesterday, out of harm's way, prospects are a little bit better in that area.
Well, Dana, I know that you look at things from the lens of quantitative analysis and metrics and looking at technical analysis. Do you do any inner market analysis, though, where you look at one asset class compared to other asset classes in your due diligence? When you're looking at the precious metals, do you look at them versus the dollar or the general markets? We've just seen a lot more news about this may be the chance for the precious metals complex to outperform the general equities.
Yeah, to be honest, we don't. That doesn't enter into our quantitative models at all. I will say when, you know, you look at some ratios, intermarket ratios on a longer term basis, that provides kind of a background lens to stepping off area to look at considering, you know, whether it's precious metals or commodities versus equities, which are extremely, the ratio is extremely cheap right now. But that can remain that way in a long time. And the other pitfall in looking at the intermarket analysis is that correlations can change. The relationships can change. In our view, it's hard enough to try to figure out where one asset is going, where the price of one asset is going, much less figure out what that price is, the price of that asset is going based on the price of a different asset. So from our mind, our point of view, we try to simplify things and judge everything, each and every ticker on its own merits. So, but it is from, like I said, from a background standpoint, it's interesting to see where you are on a historical basis, what types of assets are extremely cheap historically now, and have that potential perhaps to move much higher, and which ones are very expensive, and while they might still be in an uptrend, might not have that potential fuel left for a huge move.
Well, we've talked a lot about how undervalued commodities are, or hard assets compared to financial assets, so who knows, maybe this is the start of a change, but I think as you've outlined very well there is that this is still early on. So let's see what the follow through is. I know we say that a lot, but quite frankly, that is important because look, for gold, we have been at $1,840 before. For silver, we have been right around $25 before. And what we need is another leg higher to get some more interest in the sector. Dana, thank you as always for your time. Always interesting to hear what markets you're trading and your outlook. So we'll be chatting in another couple of weeks. In the meantime, hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure being on.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com.
You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to really focus almost exclusively on the precious metals sectors. We are chatting with Dave Erfley, founder and editor of the Junior Miner Junkie. Now, Dave, we usually chat on Tuesdays, but I'm glad we left this one to the end of the week because, well, there was quite the swings happening in precious metals. We got to Tuesday and silver started to move. And then Wednesday, boy, oh boy, gold moved higher. The gold stocks moved higher. Silver moved higher. Silver stocks moved higher. Everybody, all precious metals investors, especially that we talked to, they were excited. They were calling breakouts. They were calling a lot of things that unfortunately weren't exactly true on the charts. It was nice to see the volume bump. That was something that it really sticks with me, that we did see an increase in volume. But as we're now recording this late in the day on Friday, gold looks like it's going to close the week up about $10. The gold stocks or GDX, that's still going to be up maybe a couple percent this week, but nowhere near these breakout euphoric calls that we were getting just on Wednesday. Dave, what's your takeaway from this week when it comes strictly to the moves in the precious metals?
Yeah, Corey, we were whipsawed yet again. Well, not we, but traders were whipsawed yet again this week in the gold price. I was watching it take place on, like you mentioned in the lead up here, that silver had that big move on Tuesday. And I was very encouraged by that because the gold price was down that day. The stock market was down that day and the dollar was up huge. And yet silver made this huge 50-cent move up. And I said, well, that's got to be a tell for something. And sure enough, the next day, the gold price zoomed through 1835 resistance, which had been pretty stiff resistance for the past few months. But it did so on the the very confusing press conference that President Joe Biden held at the White House, where he basically said, it looks like Russia's going to invade. They can invade a little bit, but if they go in whole hog, then they're going to suffer consequences. Like, huh? And as soon as that took place, that's when the gold price got above 1835 and started to move towards stiffer resistance at 1850. And the silver price continues to lead. That's also very bullish in the longer term here, is silver is leading this move. And it's still holding most of its gains, although the gold price moved off and it could not even close above that stiff resistance at 1835 on a weekly basis. And as soon as whoever bought the shares after that move on Wednesday, they're taking their profits, as the miners moved right back down again when they saw that was taking place. So basically, a lesson here for anybody in this sector is that you never have much faith in a saber-rattling geopolitical move in the gold price, because it's usually sold off. And that's exactly what's happened here, especially when we're going into a very important Federal Reserve meeting next Wednesday. I know we say that every month, every Fed meeting, how important they are. But this one is super important because the market is waiting to see how the Fed is going to telegraph these rate hikes and this bond buying program that is expected to wrap up now in March. And a rate hike is over 90% priced in now. So the market is nervous about how they're going to roll this out, and they're selling their stocks. Because now you have the NASDAQ officially in correction territory, down over 10%. And before, you were seeing some rotation. You know, you were seeing the gold stocks being bought while the market was going down. But not today. The miners are going down with the stock market as they're breaking some support levels. The NASDAQ has broke its October low, so it's made a lower low. And the S&P is trying to hold its 200-day moving average. The Dow's already lost its 200-day moving average. So investors are getting nervous here into Fed speak. So it's going to be interesting how this is all going to shape out next Wednesday.
David, it is going to be interesting to see what the Fed says next week. I just want to back up, though, to the middle of this week when everybody was so jubilant. Uh-huh. And also point out that people don't need to be too depressed today just because there's a sell-off, because I think what's happening is wild swings in both directions and emotions and sentiment, and everybody's looking to find out who done it. Because when we talked to people throughout the week, some people mentioned that all the commodities were racing higher in the face of a stronger dollar, which was unusual, and I wouldn't expect to see that on a Ukraine an invasion narrative, you know, even if it's only a partial invasion. And there's also the narrative that hey, these things were oversold. They needed to bounce technically. Okay, fine. But I'm going to back up to just all the discussions we were having in December. And I guess even though it's not a popular idea, we've talked forever about there being a really bad tax loss, the worst tax loss many people had seen in a long time. And then a month later, a lot of those people are now past their 30-day wash period and buying in. Couldn't some of the support in the market, since it happened in silver first and then gold and in the mining stocks, and in a lot of other commodities, by the way, couldn't all of that be tied into some of this tax loss buying and the seasonally strong month of January that we normally see? And because it's the strongest one of the whole year, January, couldn't some of that just be tax loss selling, technical maneuvering? Does it have to have a narrative attached to it?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. I mean, especially when you see that volume spike. I mean, that volume spike on Wednesday was just as high as it was when during the last Fed speak, FOMC meeting Fed speak, when we had a strong reversal off of September bottoms in the GDX, the GDXJ, the SIL, the SILJ, and silver. Silver double bottomed at exactly 21.41. And the GDX and GDXJ and those other ETFs, they appeared to have double bottomed at their September lows as well. And that was huge volume that day. And we also saw huge volume on Wednesday, and the subsequent sell-off from the huge spike on Wednesday is half the volume of that day. So I do think that there is something in what you just laid out. I think there are sector professionals that are getting back into these quality juniors, but we still need to get the generalist investor in the sector on a bigger scale. You know, we've talked about in the past few discussions about how they're coming into Newmont, how they're coming into Barrick, and Newmont is bifurcated and is leading the sector higher. And let's face it, I mean, the gold market has been in an uptrend since the last Fed speak. It's making higher highs, it's making higher lows, and so are the gold stocks. So it might not feel like it, but they are making headway. And we know that in the past, the sector has made major bottoms around the beginnings of Fed rate hike cycles. I mean, it happened the second phase of the secular bull market began with a rate hike cycle in late 2015. The actual bull market, the first phase of the bull market, which started way back in 1999, that kicked off with a rate hike cycle as well. And also, we know that in the past, that during other inflationary periods, the gold sector has lagged the commodity sector during the first half, and then it outperforms in the second half. I mean, I did something kind of crazy myself during the last time we had an inflationary period between 2003 and 2008. The gold stocks were consolidating from 2003 to 2005, their huge move that they'd made. And I sold my house and I put all the proceeds into junior miners. And luckily, it turned out well for me as the gold price zoomed higher at the back end of that inflationary period into 2008. And the same thing happened back in during the major inflationary period back in the 70s. The gold price did the same thing. It lagged the commodities at first, and then it outperformed them in the second half. But also something to note during the second half of that move was a similar situation that's taking place when we talked about the Russian-Ukrainian situation. Well, the tail end of the gold bull market in the 70s, Russia invaded Afghanistan. And that is what was the catalyst that, that took the gold price to the blow-off top at 850. The gold price popped on expectation of this taking place. I'm starting to believe that it will take place because basically Biden's opened the door for Putin to do it. So it's going to be interesting to see what the gold price does. I mean, God forbid that it happens. I do not want to see that. I do not want to have the gold price go higher on a Russian invasion of Ukraine. But if it does take place, it's going to be interesting to see what the gold market does and how long the gains will be held if it does go higher.
Dave, what do you take away from the environment, too, of all commodities moving higher? And gold, in all fairness, is still kind of lagging all the other commodities, but wasn't just a precious metals move. And quite frankly, all commodities, base metals, energy, have all been doing quite well. How does that fit into the overall environment?
Yeah, I mean, they're very overbought. Let's face it. I mean, most of these sectors are very overbought. These other metals that we've been talking about, they're overbought. Some of them are extreme overbought. The commodities are extreme overbought. Oil's getting extreme overbought. But the one thing that's not extreme overbought is the gold sector. I mean, it continues to trade sideways while the miners continue to get sold. So this is a sector that you want to accumulate and you want to be in when the gold market finally does go up because of this inflation that the Fed is admitted they're behind the curve on. And even if they do start raising interest rates, they can't raise them too much because there's a little thing of $30 trillion of debt that hanging there. And let's face it, the unemployment situation is not getting any better. So I don't see how they can aggressively raise rates. But, the market is starting to price in that they're going to do so. And we're going to find out more next Wednesday.
Dave, another thing I was considering earlier in the week is that with the market, the general market weakness, some of that is probably jitters about these Fed rate hikes and about this Fed meeting. But there was a pretty big volume and rotation into some of the senior producers across mm-hmm. the board. I mean, many were up double digits. When you looked at companies like Hecla, Coeur, Force Majestic, it was interesting to see just how big of a bid they were getting, and it was on big volume. So do you think that was an early sign of some people maybe just putting a little bit in the sector because they were looking to pull profits in the general markets and maybe just rotate a small portion into this tiny sector?
Oh, I do. And you see it in the weakness in the general equities, which is what we've been waiting for because we need to have some of that sector rotation come in to the mining stocks. And they are holding up better than the juniors here. And like I said, the move down the last 2 days is on much lower volume. So I do think that some of that move was sector rotation. And I expect that sector rotation to continue.
So, Dave, what are you doing within your portfolio? What are you telling to your subscribers in terms of buying, selling, and what style of companies are you interested in if you are buying right now?
Well, since late last year, I rotated out of drill plays that had yet to define a resource. I'm still exposed to that sector with warrants that have yet to expire in a few companies. And I do have one other drill play that is basically a free ride. I took my original investment out of it after it tripled. So it's a no-risk situation. But I've been basically scaling into what the majors, the type of juniors that the majors have been accumulating. And that is single asset juniors de-risking high margin projects that are in the later stages. You know, that's basically what the majors are concentrating on. And it doesn't make much sense to me to take a chance on some of these drill plays that have yet to define a resource that are much higher risk when you have these other companies that are de-risking these high margin projects. They're district scale size. They're in good jurisdiction. They have great management. They're cashed up. They've already proved up all these ounces in the ground and they're at the later stage of doing so. Those are on sale. So it doesn't make much sense to me to take a chance on drill plays right here. So I've been doing that, and I invested into my last one earlier this week. So I'm basically walking my talk here, and I'm pretty much all in. I don't have any cash left, because I think a major bottom is being created here. It has been doing so since last September.
All right, Dave. Boy, oh boy, was it ever an interesting week. And that's why I'm also telling everybody that's listening on the radio or just listening to the weekend show, be sure to go back through our website throughout this week, because we had a lot of comments both from analysts and company updates covering some of those moves in the markets. Plus, again, a lot of news that came out of companies that we are following closely. So, Dave, everybody, thanks for taking time with us on this weekend show. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend. And, well, let's follow up next week, because there's a lot of stuff happening next week that will undoubtedly continue this volatility. Dave, again, thanks for your time this weekend.
Thank you.